Hello everyone and welcome to Raya Affairs. My name is Nicola and as always I'll be your host for this episode. Raya is a youth-led international think tank that translates the abstract world of international affairs by simplifying rather than generalizing. Raya is a place where you come to learn about the stories and worries of political leaders, the behind-the-scenes of decision-makers, and how politics impacts and changes your life. This is Raya Affairs, filling you in wherever you are. As always, we start with a disclaimer that expressed opinion in this episode are welcome, even though they are not a direct reflection of Raya, as we specialize in unbiased writing. This episode is the fifth in a series of six as part of the IE Raya Summer Research Program of 2025. Raya has invited 12 IE University students to join our think tank and spend 9 weeks researching a figure from around the world to try to answer a simple question. Are they a climate leader? During their research, students have done a deep dive of the person's background, policies, and the impact of said policies in an effort to bring light to the diverse ways in which every person, no matter the role they play in society, can contribute to the global climate change policy framework. In today's episode, we will be focusing on Mohammed VI, King of Morocco. And here with us, we have Finia Ulrich and Alexei Obradovic. Welcome to Raya Affairs, guys. It's a pleasure to have you here, and thank you very much for joining me today. Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Yes. Firstly, thank you so much for having us. I'm Finia. I'm from Germany, and I'm currently a third-year student at IE studying international relations.
Thanks so much for having us, Nicola. I'm really happy to be here. My name is Alexei Obradovic, and I'm a third-year student of business administration and international relations at IE University. I'm originally from Serbia and Norway, so I've always kind of had a mix of perspectives when it comes to policy, and this project really allowed me to explore how different parts of the world are approaching climate policy.
Well, thank you very much for the introduction, guys. It's a pleasure to meet you. And before we start, I'll ask you to answer our usual ice-breaking question. This is a question we ask every guest here on the podcast. So could you tell us which leader, either dead or alive, who has impacted the world, would you want to have a conversation with and why?
Yes, that's a great question. I think I would pick Greta Thunberg, mainly because we've been also mainly focusing on climate, and she's been a massive impact in that direction. And of course, also showing how young voices can drive global movements. But I think specifically now, I would like to ask her how her journey was whilst she was on the Freedom Flotile to Gaza. I think it was a bold move that connects climate activism with human rights and political solidarity. And I don't know, I'd just love to hear her perspective, and also from more of a global citizen, because I think it'd be quite an eye-opening conversation to have.
I think if I had the chance to have a conversation with any leader, I would have chosen Patrice Lumumba, the first prime minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. And why I think that his story is, while very inspirational, it's also very tragic. I mean, he was a visionary who really believed in Pan-African unity and sovereignty and, you know, the right of African nations to control their own resources and policies and destiny. And these ideas are actually tragically very relevant today, and especially when we talk about the context of climate policy, actually.
Wow, those are really interesting picks, guys. As always, when I ask this question, I always receive different answers, but it's always nice and interesting to hear the perspective of our guests, who they would like to meet and speak with. It's always interesting to hear. And thank you very much, guys. So I would say that now we can start our conversation about your report on King Mohammed VI. And in your report, you describe him as a climate leader, but not in the way we usually think of one, not in the kind of activist sense of it. His environmental agenda is deeply tied to Morocco's broader goals of development, security, and economic transformation. So could you please walk us through his background and explain what makes his approach to climate leadership so unique?
Yes, of course. Let's dive right in. When we talk about climate leaders, maybe we have a specific image in our head. Maybe someone like Greta Thunberg usually comes into our heads, and someone who's outspoken, activist-driven, and entirely focused on environmental justice to the most part. And maybe at first glance, someone like King Mohammed VI isn't maybe your typical climate leader. And some may even question whether he is. But we're here today to argue that we see him as a climate leader. And let me explain why we think so. First, King Mohammed's VI approach to climate leadership is deeply strategic. So for him, it's not just about protecting the environment. It's also about linking climate action to national security, development, and economic transformation. I think he really recognized early on that Morocco, being especially vulnerable to climate change, needed to protect itself, not just ecologically, but socially and economically. So specifically, what I mean with this is that his environmental policies have always been part of a broader vision. So, for example, like eradicating poverty and reducing food and water stress to stabilize the country, especially after a difficult period in history. The one I'm referring to is the years of Lead. It was a political period of oppression, and he kind of saw the green investment not just as a moral choice, but as a smart way to create jobs, attract global funding, and generate long-term revenue. So especially in sectors like the agriculture and tourism, which are vital to Morocco's economy and are also very exposed to climate risks. So while he may not be your typical grassroots climate figure, I say his leadership shows how environmental policy can be also more of a development strategy. And that's a powerful, different kind of way of a climate leadership, I'd say.
In your report, you explain how Morocco is confronted with many environmental challenges. You identify the most significant ones in desertification, extreme weather conditions, and sea level rise. And I would like to start to talk about the first one, desertification. You write that approximately 90% of Morocco's land is at risk of desertification due to extreme temperature and precipitation changes. Could you please explain how desertification is reshaping Morocco's economy and society? And why does King Mohammed see it as such a political and security risk?
Yes, absolutely. So I'd say that desertification is one of, like you said, Morocco's biggest environmental challenges. And it's not just about the land drying up. It has serious social and economic consequences. And like you said, like around 90% of the country's land is at risk of becoming consequence to desertification and rising temperatures and less rainfall. And the Saharan region is creeping further and further northeast. And this hits rural communities the hardest. So around 80% of people in those areas who work, for example, in agriculture, are obviously very dependent on rainfall. So when the climate does shift, crops suffer and food becomes scarce and poverty gets worse. And here's when it becomes more than just an environmental issue, because Morocco has already experienced what happens when food systems break down. And we've seen this during the 80s, mainly in Casablanca, during the food riots, where it was triggered by food prices rising and things escalated. And we saw hundreds of people being killed and thousands being injured. And that's why King Mohammed VI sees desertification as a political and security issue as well. It's not just about protecting the land, it's about avoiding instability. And the economic costs are huge, with it being over 2 billion a year. But even more worrying is the risk of unrest if people can't access basic resources. So it's a top priority for the country for sure.
Yeah, it definitely is. Thank you very much, Finia. And the second environmental challenge that you analyze is extreme weather events. Your report goes into great detail about how floods, droughts, and changing rainfall patterns are impacting key sectors like agriculture and tourism. Could you please summarize how these extreme weather events are already affecting the local economy? And why are they such a critical priority for the King's environmental policies?
Yes, of course. So extreme weather events like floods, droughts, and unpredictable rainfall are already having a serious impact on Morocco's economy. And again, I keep repeating these two, but it's the main ones that are important. It's agriculture and tourism. So agriculture uses about 85% of the country's water, and tourism also heavily depends on it. So think like resorts, pools, and landscaped areas in these tourism sectors, which are highly dependent on water. But with more frequent floods destroying farmlands and droughts lasting months in some regions, water is becoming increasingly scarce and unreliable. This directly affects crop production and makes it harder to sustain tourism as well, especially in these typical luxurious resorts, which are very water intensive, which we see as well in the Plan Azur, which is a governmental plan to increase the tourism sector within Morocco. But yeah, back to the rainfall patterns, they're also shifting, making it hard to plan ahead. So some areas flood while others dry out completely. And all of this puts enormous pressures on communities, jobs, and food supply. So that's why extreme weather is such a top priority for King Mohammed VI. Because again, it's not just about the environmental issue, it's an economic and social one. And if we don't act, we risk food insecurity, rising poverty, and slow development process for Morocco.
And the last environmental challenge that you discuss is rising sea levels, mainly affecting the country's coastal regions, where, however, most of the population and major economic activities are concentrated. How serious is this threat in practical terms, and what are the potential social and economic consequences if it is not addressed?
Yes, rising sea levels is definitely one of Morocco's biggest environmental challenges. This just isn't about water inching up the shoreline. I can give you some examples. So a 4-meter rise could submerge 10% of the country's land, and an 11-meter rise could cover a quarter of the coastal areas, which would be a huge risk. These are huge amounts, so around 60-65% of the population who lives along these coastlines would be affected. And again, many of these areas rely on agriculture and tourism, which are also mainly scattered around these coastal lines. Yes, and then moving on to saltwater intrusion, it's already damaging crops and contaminating freshwater. It's threatening food production and public health. And we also see that coastal agriculture is especially vulnerable. And if no action is taken, many people will be displaced as a consequence. And tourism would also suffer immensely, with resorts and infrastructure facing major relocation problems and destruction of their infrastructure. And then regarding the Moroccan government, they've launched now a 200 million emergency plan, but more is needed, because without serious adaptation efforts, decades of development could be undone. So in short, what I'm trying to say is that rising sea levels aren't just an environmental issue. As said, there are major social and economic risks, and that demand definitely urgent action.
Yes, and that seems like a recurring theme across the three different environmental challenges that we analyze here, because in all the three cases, as we saw, we're not only talking about an environmental issue, but as Finia pointed out, those environmental issues have also major social and economic risk associated with them. And now moving to the next topic. In the report, you identify the COP22, hosted in Marrakesh in 2016, as the king's defining moment, when he shifted from being known mainly as a domestic reformer to becoming a global climate advocate. On the summit sidelines, the king also convened the first Africa Action Summit, gathering African heads of state to create a common and shared stance on climate change. What made his leadership at COP22 so significant, and what has been the effect of the conference on his role, on Morocco's role, and the whole African continent's role in international climate diplomacy?
Absolutely. COP22, which was held in Marrakesh in 2016, was a landmark moment, not just for like the global climate diplomacy, but also for Morocco and King Mohammed personally. It came right after the adoption of the Paris Agreement, and Morocco was suddenly at the center of all these important global climate conversations. Now, what made the King's leadership especially significant was how he used COP22 to elevate Morocco's role as a climate bridge, particularly between Africa and the rest of the world. Now, for example, he convened the first Africa Action Summit on the sidelines of the conference, bringing together more than 30 African heads of state. That summit resulted in the launch of the initiative Adaptation of African Agriculture, which aimed to boost the continent's resilience in the face of drought and food security, which occurs regularly there. This was not just symbolic. By 2016, Morocco had already pledged to cut their emissions by 32% by 2030 and committed to sourcing 52% of their electricity from renewables by 2030. So Morocco was doing the work at home, but COP22 gave the King a global platform to demonstrate the leadership and to position himself as a climate actor for the global south. And it, as you said, it marked a shift from being a policy reformer focused on just modernization to being an active international actor in climate policy.
And we've talked before about the three main environmental challenges affecting Morocco today. So now I would like to move to the policies that were implemented by King Mohammed to fight climate change. And those policies, at least the ones that you analyze in the report, are the Green Morocco Plan, the National Energy Strategy, and the National Adaptation Plan. Let's start with the Green Morocco Plan, which was launched in 2008, basically as a strategy to promote socioeconomic development through the modernization of the agricultural sector, which, as we saw, is a huge part of the country's economic activity. Could you please explain how this policy worked in practice and what have been its positive impacts and its main limitations?
Yes, perfect. So the Green Morocco Plan, or Plan Maroc Vert, if you prefer the French version, launched in 2008. And it was the first major sustainable development policy introduced under the King. It was designed to modernize Morocco's agricultural sector, which accounts for about 14% of the national GDP. And the policy had two main pillars, one which focused on high-value export crops like citrus, olives, vegetable, fruits and vegetables mainly, and another aimed at improving the productivity of small-scale farmers and also decreasing their dependence on grain imports. Now, over its first decade, the plan attracted more than 10 billion euros in investment, including through public-private partnership, and it helped increase the agriculture GDP by nearly 60% between 2008 and 2018, and created, with that, thousands of rural jobs. But as you said, of course, like there were a lot of significant limitations to the project too. The focus on these export-led, water-intensive crops still placed a very big strain on Morocco's already scarce water resource, as when you increase the scale of the project so much, even though you introduce smart irrigation systems and other ways to more effectively use the resources, at such a big scale, it's still going to be intensive. So while the plan improved some of the infrastructure and access to markets for some of the stakeholders, others, especially like the smallholder farmers in very marginal areas, were still left behind. So social inequality actually widened in some of the cases, and Morocco still remained very dependent on grain imports for basic food security. So although the Green Morocco Plan made agriculture more competitive, it didn't fully integrate environmental sustainability or equity across all the regions.
And the second policy that you analyzed is the National Energy Strategy, implemented by King Mohammed in 2009. The strategy is formulated in three key pillars: increasing renewable energy, improving energy efficiency, and fostering regional integration. So I would like to ask you, what projects have been developed to achieve these goals? And what do you see as the most important achievements and perhaps challenges of these strategies so far?
Yes, so the National Energy Strategy, which was adopted in 2009, aimed to transform Morocco's energy sector, which was very dependent on imports for over 90% of its needs. The strategy set an ambitious target to increase the share of renewables installed to 42% by 2020, and then now, after 2020, to 52% by 2030. One of the most important, or in my opinion, the most important achievement is the Noor Solar Complex, which is a massive solar complex installation that can power over 1 million homes and avoid about 700,000 tons of CO2 emissions annually. There are also large wind farms in Tarfea and Tangier and small hydro projects to support the grid diversification. Now, the strategy also attracted significant foreign direct investment and positioned Morocco as a leader in renewable energies in Africa. However, the challenges are still real. Many projects are large-scale and foreign-funded, meaning that local ownership and community benefit can be very limited. And there's also a gap in energy access and energy efficiency, especially in rural areas, of course. And while Morocco has positioned itself well globally, the decentralization of energy production and just transition principles need a lot more attention, I would say.
And the last initiative that we will discuss today is the National Adaptation Plan. Started by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change in 2010, the plan was adopted by Morocco in 2016. And it is essentially a five-pillar climate strategy plan, focusing on strong institutions, scientific research, vulnerability mitigation, ecosystem resilience, and economic resilience. Could you please explain to our audience what these five pillars consist of and what have been the successes and the shortcomings of the policies implemented as part of the plan?
Yes, definitely. Let me break you down the Moroccan National Adaptation Plan, also known as the NAP1. Looking at the five pillars, we can start with the first one, like you outlined, strong institutions. Morocco created national climate bodies to guide policy and oversight. That's definitely a big step, but critics say it's still too centralized and limiting local involvement. Then the second one, the second pillar, is scientific research. The country invested in advanced risk assessments and launched the 4C Morocco to improve data and research, but still technical gaps and inconsistency within the data at local regions remain an issue. Then for the third pillar, vulnerability mitigation, the point of it is to protect people from floods, droughts, and other disasters. But Morocco introduced disaster insurance and invested in infrastructure. But again, critics say that there's limitations in regard to looking too much into the water supply solutions like dams rather than managing the demand more fairly. Then, if we look at the fourth pillar, ecosystem resilience, programs like Forests of Morocco are restoring lands and supporting rural jobs. But again, ongoing droughts and wildfires are still making this a big problem and limiting its successes. Finally, the last pillar, economic resilience. This includes climate smart farming, renewable energy, and drought resistant crops. But not everyone benefits equally, as small farmers often lack access to these tools, risking greater inequality. So what did all this mean now? Looking at NAP1, it has definitely raised Morocco's climate profile. It has increased funding and laid the groundwork for long-term action. But the real test is making sure those policies work for everyone, and especially vulnerable communities. It's still a big limitations within these pillars, and the vision is strong, But to succeed, Morocco needs more inclusive, locally driven solutions on the ground.
My last question is about the bigger picture, because you spent 9 weeks researching King Mohammed VI. And this is a question that I asked all the different groups that we had here as part of the IE Raya summer research program. And I always asked them if they could tell me in their own words, if they believe that their leader should be actually considered a climate leader. So I will ask you, after all this research, do you believe King Mohammed VI should be considered a climate leader? And what lessons can other developing countries take from the way he has tried to integrate climate action and national development?
Yes. So as Finja mentioned earlier in the podcast, we do believe that King Mohammed VI can be considered a climate leader, but as also you said, Nicola, not in a traditional activist sense. His leadership is way more strategic and embedded in long-term development and planning. And, you know, as both me and Finja being Europeans, not very, like, directly impacted by climate change and climate crises, this has been something that we had to step out of our own comfort zone to kind of explore. So rather than treating climate as a standalone issue, he's made it a developmental priority, from agriculture to water and energy and also diplomacy. His strengths lie in mobilizing national and international resources to meet these ambitious goals. Policies like the Green Morocco Plan, the National Energy Strategy, and more recently the National Adaptation Plan all reflect this kind of integrated strategy. And when you look at the scale, Morocco, for example, aiming for over 50% of renewable energy, or expanding their drip irrigation systems to 550,000 hectares, it's clear that their commitment is present and there. That said, leadership isn't just about their vision, you know, it's also about the results. And Morocco still faces huge challenges on water scarcity, regional inequality, and implementation gaps. But perhaps the biggest lesson for other countries is that climate policy doesn't have to come at the cost of development. If anything, Morocco shows that climate ambition can be a driver for development and modernization and investment, and also, very important, regional cooperation.
Yes, and I think this was actually the recurring theme, kind of the recurring theme of the whole episode, this ability to link climate action and climate policies to national development. And I think that after reading your report and having you here on the podcast, I know a little bit more about how King Mohammed is trying to achieve these goals. So basically implementing sustainable climate policies while also taking care of the country's national development. And I would say that with this, we can end today's episode. Thank you very much again to Finja and Alexei for joining me today. It has been a pleasure to have you here on Raya Affairs. I will remind to our audience that this has been the fifth in a series of six episodes as part of the IE Raya Summer Research Program of 2025. Stay tuned because our last episode will come out soon as well. And if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to check out Finja and Alexei's report at rayagroup.org. And to follow us on social media to receive updates on new articles and contents. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.